Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, friends. This is Nick, and I'm here with my co-host, Terry, and this is Hell No, the radio show. Hell No, the radio show is a socially conscious water cooler talk show about what's going on in the world as we feature some guests and callers who express their thoughts. Hell No is friendly, funny, real, and focused on empowering the truth. We give a voice to people who feel left in the dust. This program is not democratic, it's not fascist, politically correct, or a place for sacred cows. What we do is we advocate for peace, critical thought, education, reading, and social awareness. So go ahead and write down this telephone number and give Terry and me a call and share your thoughts on our discussion-stirring topics on tonight's Hell No episode, which, by the way, is a new feature on tools. I think everyone's going to love it. It's exciting. All right, here's that telephone number, y'all. It's 718-508-9419. Then when you're prompted, dial option number one. Again, that telephone number is 718-508-9419. Hell No is a one-hour show, and we take your calls in the order we receive them, so please sit tight. Want to also let you all know that we can receive emails at any time at hellnoradioshow@gmail.com. Also find all our episodes anytime on our Facebook page, Hell No the Radio Show, on Facebook and on Twitter, at Hell No Radio Show. Easiest way to find all those, by the way, is just to do it Google or Bing, whatever search engine you use. Just do a search for Hell No the Radio Show. Social media works well. People send us messages with ideas all the time. And, of course, as always, partial support for Hell No the Radio Show comes from our sponsors, and Terry's going to tell us about them now.
Our longtime friend and sponsor, Ms. Jane Flint, body worker and massage therapist extraordinaire, located at 10335 West Oklahoma Avenue in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Just an amazing lady and someone who has incredible hands. She's a miracle with the muscles. I can't say enough about her skill level, her ability to diagnose, if you can call it that. I know I'm not supposed to use that word. The FDA shudders when I say that, or somebody shudders. But she's able to locate problems. She's able to identify problems. How's that? And whether it's just relaxation massage or whether it's something that you've got an old injury that's in need of assistance, or a new injury, or you name it. And the nice thing is she's very science-based. No woo-hoo, new age. She's very, very good at what she does. She works in a manner that's very logical. She tries to isolate problems and then come up with innovative solutions on them. She's worked with a number of different conditions, like muscular dystrophy, to great effect, by the way. People who suffer from that are really unfortunate folks who are missing some genetic material. There's no pill that you can give them to replace that. So manipulative therapy is one of the few things that can give them the relief and mobility that one would like to afford anyone in that situation. We want to mention her phone number, and I want to mention a couple of other things about massage therapy going on to our program. But phone number is 414-321-9030. That's 414-321-9030. And by the way, if you mention our program, she will, in fact, give you $10 off your first appointment. If you are within 100 miles, it is worth the trip to go see her. 10335 West Oklahoma Avenue, Miss Jane Flint, massage therapist extraordinaire. We've talked about this many times, Nick, how in this country the perception of massage ranges from luxury on down to salaciousness. And in most other countries, especially European and Oriental countries, massage is looked at as just part of your normal medical situation. It is a therapeutic and sometimes relaxation situation where, I'll tell you, it's It's like nothing else. Good massage therapist can really help you out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, something that we talked about briefly before the show today is the experience I had recently with a PhD nurse and faculty member at a well-known research hospital in one of our major cities. And we were on a program similar to this, but a more professional program. Sorry, Terry. Talking about nursing and nursing professions and careers and so on, kind of for a healthcare purpose. And one of the things that I learned was that within the nursing, first of all, there's a shortage of nurses out there. Second of all, the people who are going into nursing and healthcare now, the new way that it's kind of a schema and a shift of a paradigm shift of the approach to healthcare as being more preventative now, which is very close to the way it's always been done in certain other cultures. But the payment is circulated around keeping people healthy and going to doctors and nurses and focusing on positive health and paying them for that, not just wait till they're sick.
Well, and I brought up something that I talked about on another show, which was the ancient Chinese really had it right, because what they would do is they would pay their doctors every month. They had to pay them a stipend until they became ill. When they became ill, they stopped paying their doctor. So the impetus for the doctor was to jump on it immediately, get them feeling better in the quickest possible manner, so he'd start getting paid again. So the object at all times was to keep their patients well. They would go out of their way to come up with not just palliative treatments, but situations where they made their folks aware of health conditions or things they could do to stay healthier, something we don't do much of in this country. We do a little window dressing, but for the most part, we just don't do
it. It's true, and when I first encountered a friend of mine who was going into chiropractic, he struggled with this idea of having people come in for, I guess maybe it was more of the car accidents, telling them to come in more than he thought they needed. But other than that, though, when I've gone to chiropractors and they've done a once over, they'll do a scan and show you this and that, and they talk about preventative health and, their nervous system and everything that works with that, keeping everything moving correctly, longer life. And I just thought it was so odd. And, of course, the first thing I think is, well, what kind of a business model is this? What kind of a shame? You're going to tell me there's nothing wrong with me. Why do I need to come to you? But when you start changing the way that you think about it and look at these things, and the more that I hear about more real preventative things, putting massage in there with the chiropractor, I have no problem going once a month doing that, combine those, get the good hour massage and then get worked on by the chiropractor. And, for anyone who's had any sort of breaks, bones, or injuries in the past, it almost seems like a no-brainer at a certain age. But so I totally endorse it all.
Well, keeping healthy certainly contributes to greater longevity, especially functional longevity. And that's something that Americans just don't seem to get. Staying alive until you're 90, if 90 finds you in a wheelchair, not able to recognize your own toes, and somebody feeding you with a tube, that's not what I consider longevity. That's existence, and barely. Longevity is when you have functional longevity, when you are still doing the things that you did before, and you're still capable of it. And we chatted a little bit before the show about some of the folks who've been in the news recently. I just brought one up a few minutes ago, a gentleman who was 91 years old. Someone tried to rob him outside of a pharmacy in Detroit.
It was
bad news for the guy who tried to rob him. There were actually two guys.
Yeah, Grandpa was packing.
Yeah, he was, and he ended up shooting the guy and putting him in the hospital. He warned him in advance that he was, that he was on and lay off, but the guy didn't listen, and he nailed him, and good for him.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he was still able to shoot, the fact that he still carried his concealed weapons permit with him, and did the right thing, warned the guy, said, you're threatening my life and my money. You're going to get it. He got it. But
yep, it was
in far greater extremes, two of the other folks that we were talking about. And Nick, I'd like you to chime in on the gentleman who's walking across the United States, a former World War II participant and a veteran, obviously. Just remarkable, absolutely remarkable. How old is he?
The man's 93 years old.
Okay.
93 years old. His name is Ernie Andrews, or Andrus,
mm-hmm.
or probably Andrews, and he has gone across America. The man's a World War II veteran, and local media has been following this. He started October 7th, 2013, so 3 years ago, on the center of San Diego, and
yep.
Weaving
and
his way over
clarify,
through the years. Guy's gone all over the
clarify
place.
Clarify one thing. When you said he's going across America, that doesn't mean he's driving or taking the bus. He's walking and running. That's how he's getting around.
Absolutely. It's like Forrest Gump story. And, you know, one day I started running and I just kept going.
Yep.
You know, he's not the only person. When I was doing research on this today, I found there's another gentleman whose name I don't recall right now, but his name had a K. I think it started with a K and had a Z in it, the last name, but I saw like a picture, but it narrows it down. But anyone who's running through it, I mean, you'll find it. But this other guy can run for 3 days straight. I found all sorts of people who are doing these walks and runs from, you know, coast to coast in different places around the world, not just here in the
mm-hmm.
U.S., but it's really interesting. This guy who ran across America, turned 93 on Friday, said he was running money originally to raise. He was raising money for a World War II era ship that's in Indiana, and they wanted to ship it from to Normandy, France, for the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Now, how's that
yep.
for a way to? You know, here I'm thinking I'm cool because I'm going door to door selling pies for Thanksgiving. This guy is like.
Yep.
I mean, it's, you know, and the thing is, I always, when I mention these stories to my friends and people, you know, I say it's my grandma's generation. Like, grandma's 96, you know, when I saw her this summer, and I'm sure she'll make 97. She's going to be around for a long time. You know, there's a lot of longevity out there in the world. But then why is it that my parents' generation, they seem to be kicking off in their late 60s, early 70s, you know? So I don't know. You know, some people talk about exposure to different chemicals, this and that. Some people talk about food. You know, talking today to someone, the mayor, she's a former mayor, she was the original mayor from my town, turned 100 this last week. And, you know, I brought it up today. So, you know, I wonder what's the secret? What do they eat? Do they just eat bacon and this? And she said, oh, that she ate fish out of the lake right here for years. And I thought I wouldn't eat fish out of that lake to save my life. But, you know, because I'm thinking it's not clean and safe, but
yeah.
I mean, you just
well,
never
you
know.
There are many factors involved. Genetics are always huge. Activity is huge. I always use Jack LaLanne as an example. For those of you who don't remember Jack LaLanne, he was an exercise specialist, and on his birthday every year he would perform some strength and endurance-related stunt. One year he swam from the shore over to Alcatraz, handcuffed, pulling a boat. You know, these are the kinds of things that he would do. Now, what's interesting about Jack LaLanne is not the fact that he was able to do these things at a relatively advanced age, but the fact that he was a terribly sickly child. They never did figure out what he had, but he had something pretty devastating when he was young. And he was very weak, an absolutely frail individual. And his mother was a European lady, very stalwart and kind of stocky. But she believed that eating right and exercise was going to help him, and it did. And he became not only an exercise aficionado, but he also became a bodybuilder and, you know, did weightlifting and had his own exercise shows and eventually sold juicers on the internet. But he lived into his late 80s. I don't remember exactly how old he was when he died, but the point is that he was somebody who probably would not have lived past 50 or 60, and he extended his life that way, and right up and almost until the very end. Interestingly, he was healthy and active, so his functional lifespan was tremendously long, tremendously long. You know, in his 80s, he was out ballroom dancing, and so on. That also brings to mind some of the ladies that I've seen recently who were filmed doing ballroom dancing and modern dancing, who were in their late 90s. Just incredible stuff to see. These folks take it seriously. You know, they're not going down easy. And when they drop, it's sort of like, okay, it's the end, but man, I had a great time doing it.
Impressive.
Far better that than the guy in the wheelchair with the drool cup. You know, that's not living. That's not living. Who's our other champ that I told you about?
We were also talking about as far as, and this individual is significantly younger, but setting records for doing things in her age group, and it's Olympic medalist, 41-year-old Oksana Chusovitina.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. So she is 41 years
gymnast.
Old.
Everybody,
yep.
Stop and think about this for a moment. Olympic gymnasts have a relatively short life in terms of the sport. Time they're in their late 20s. Gymnastics takes a tremendous toll on the body. This lady, at 7 Olympics. She's been in 7 Olympics in a sport that is incredibly taxing on the body, that requires remarkable coordination. The very fact that she qualified for the Olympics at age 41 is nothing short of a miracle. But she went on to compete. Now, did you find out if she medaled or not? Did she get a medal for anything?
I want to. Is her 9 world medals? She has 9 world medals. I don't recall. I'm scanning here.
Yes,
I don't know if she did this time or not. But
I watched a film of her yesterday that was absolutely astounding. And you know, here she is with kids who are 16 and 17 years old, and better than theirs are. Now that's just beyond belief. I mean, it's hard enough to get into the winner's circle in gymnastics if you are an absolute master. You know, we all thought that little Miss Biles was going to sweep it all, and she did pretty well, but didn't do as well as we thought she would. That's the young black girl who was considered the best of the best this year at the Olympics. And here she is. Here's this lady, 41 years old, right up there competing with her. Now, that's just phenomenal. Good for her. And she's already talking about the next Olympics. I mean, she comes in at age 45. You know, that's just nuts. It's crazy good. Big hell yes for every one of those folks.
Taking
life seriously from the standpoint of wanting to live it to its fullest and do the best they can at something and enjoy it while they're doing it. Those are folks who are living their lives. They are enjoying
this, and
they are living.
She was from Uzbekistan, part of the former USSR, and
right.
Born the same year I was, 1975. And you know, they talk about in this ESPN article about her learning gymnastics through training in Soviet system and you know Soviet Russia, where but just impressive what this woman has gone. I mean, that's tough. I mean, I wonder, you know, then Soviet back then, you know, in late 70s, early 80s, what did she, you know, she was the engine pushing cars around or something? What? You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Pretty nuts.
A big hell yes for these people. And I hope that some of the young people will take heed of this and start to emulate these folks and start looking at a healthier lifestyle, start looking at, you know, if you're going to have a long life, make it a good one. Make it one that is functional. Make it one that you are still up and around. You know, if you're going to live to 90, then by God, you should be walking around and doing things at 90,
right.
So you're still enjoying your life.
Let's pick up one of our
I just want to throw one tiny anecdote in here. There's a gentleman down in Missouri up in the Ozark Mountains. His name was Roby Myers, and I met Roby when he was 104. He came out to the nature reserve down in the Ozarks, and I had him visit because he was the only guy who still remembered the correct names for all of the different mountains and knobs, as they call them there. And it was really a pleasure to meet the man. And at 104, he was taking care of his wife, who was ailing, and she was 102. So Roby had his hands full. He lived to about 106, and the man had a very, very good lifespan and saw a lot of things in that lifetime that none of us got to see. So let's go. Are we going to jump in and grab one of our callers and jump
we
on?
We are. We're going to pick on a caller here and find out what the thoughts are on longevity and what they're going to do. And the way that we do this on Hell No, the radio show, is we call out the last four digits of that telephone number, and this is one who ends in 6838. Caller, you are live with Nick and Terry.
Good evening. Hey, Nick. Hey, Terry.
Hey, that voice sounds very familiar. Very familiar. Welcome to the show. And, folks, for the rest of you, call in. Talk to us. This is a talk show, even though we do a lot of the talking sometimes, maybe too much. But, please, we want you to call in. We'd like to hear from you. How are you?
718-508-9419.
Doing very good. Doing very good. What I'd like to add, and maybe this is a segue, but I think that as we talk about longevity and encouraging children to make good choices so that they can maintain longevity, quality of life, I also hear us reflecting back to the importance of connecting with our community of elders. And I think that is so vitally important that we, and not all of us have that opportunity. I'm fortunate enough to have the opportunity so that I can connect with people who are of significantly different generations than me. And I had that opportunity growing up. And I see that as something that balances me as a parent, but also helps to balance my child as well, is there is a level of knowledge, a level of relationship with that generation or those generations that's different. I think that's vitally important that connection is kept and maintained.
Well, I want to throw out a little anecdote here that happened 2 days ago. I was in a store talking to someone I knew. I ran into them in the store, and they were talking about their son. And their son is about 4 years old or 5 years old. And one of the neighbors had called police on him and protective services because he let his kid play out in the mud out in the backyard. This is the kind of ridiculousness. And again, you know, going back to our pathetically correct society, he really had the right response. And that was he yelled at the other person who had called these people and said, you know, my kid isn't sick. Your kid is about twice a week. I'll let him play in the mud all I want. It's developing his immune system. And he's right. He's absolutely right. 100% right.
Well,
going back to many things that we've said, it's one of the reasons that kids in rural areas, if they work in farms and what have you, develop some pretty healthy immune systems.
Well, and, you know, I guess I go back to, you know, as we talk about kids and balancing and issues such as that, I think that it's, you know, part of keeping children in balance is, first of all, keeping yourself as a parent in balance, And I think that, first of all, takes some acknowledgement that as a parent, your first impulse in loving is to control. And that's fine the first 1, 2, 3 years. There's a lot of that going on. And then the rest of it is learning how not to be that way.
My mother used to leave me on the train tracks a lot. And somehow I always made it off before the train got there.
There you
go. As parents,
I learned to be very good about trains. Yeah.
How do we maintain a sense of balance in our home with our children when we are in an adult world filled with childlike behavior?
No. I need to correct you. Childish behavior, not childlike.
Childish behavior about all this political bullshit. I mean, just this PC correctness. This is craziness that somebody would call DSS because a kid is playing in the mud. I mean,
yeah, they wanted to report him for child abuse.
Okay,
you know?
We've seen an erosion of our income, an erosion of our standard of living from not only where we grew up as children, but from where we began parenting. So our kids have taken that hit as well. We're in a constant turmoil about terrorism. You know, we have to control ourselves as parents in terms of how we are going to instill a sense of safety, a sense of still a sense of security, a sense of self ability to defend, or at least to instill judgment skills, and that is critical thinking.
Yep.
I'll kind of be quiet and let y'all jump in.
You know, I think one of the there's so much of parents telling, it's like top-down instruction, you know, do this, don't do this, yet there's not enough observing how kids interact with others and commenting and complimenting them on, you know, soon there with after, you know, hey, thank you for being polite, acknowledging that when they're polite, that reinforcement behavior, that, you know, I noticed it with a friend of mine when her son was 10 years old, and he was telling a story about something. He's all among adults. And, you know, I asked him, instead of, you know, a lot of times adults would kind of like to skim over the children and to incorporate the children in conversation and acknowledge what they're talking about. And her father pointed it out, and I thought, you know, that's a good point. How often we just say, oh, well, they're not talking as part of adult conversation, so we just kind of, you know, nix them out of the conversation. So it's very good points.
Well, and the converse side of that is we shouldn't try to talk to a four-year-old as an adult because it doesn't make any sense to them. And that's, you got to, as our caller said, you have to sort of find a balance. You take the woman who, you know, little Johnny has just done something awful in the backyard and ripped up all the flowers and, you know, kicked the neighbor's cat. And Mrs. Smith is on her knees trying to explain to Johnny that that is just incorrect behavior. Johnny is looking up at the tree, planning his next nefarious act, and listening to absolutely nothing that she's saying. So at that point, you know, what's the correct thing to do? Well, we can't even talk about it. You know, at that point.
In my childhood, I got
smacked, and that got my attention much more quickly than somebody kneeling down and trying to talk to me as an adult, because I wasn't an adult. And just like any other primate, at that age, we ain't thinking too clear, and only certain things are going to get our attention. And a good whack on the rear is something that gets your attention.
Especially in the middle of a busy shopping mall, and then your father gets a round of applause and a standing ovation by, like, all the shoppers.
Well, nowadays, your father gets put in jail.
You would
really
get out of the jail, really. You would.
Yeah.
Right.
I've I've told that story too many times on the radio with the lady who was in the supermarket with her kid, and the kid had just knocked all the cans off of a shelf and whomped them one. And the next thing that happened was the manager calling the police. You know, it was just, I managed to help get her out of the store.
You know, for me, my poor mother growing up with three young boys, you know, several years apart, you know, like, mama, like, you know, hitting one of us in the checkout line at Piggly Wiggly, that was just a conversation starter for the next person.
Exactly, yeah.
She said, anytime you see my boys, you hit them too, you know.
My mama pinched me. She would pinch me on the back of the arm.
Ouch.
Yeah, that
would get your attention, I suppose. Well, you know, we're at a point where people are having to go back to school, a time of year I always hated. Boy, did I hate that. It was the end of my freedom. It was like I got locked back up in jail again. But I thought we could sort of celebrate the idea of not going back to school with Mr. Alice Coopers today. So, Maestro, take it away with Alice Cooper. Guy. Very, very interesting guy. So,
yes.
Anybody? Are we there? All right. On to other things. And I want to give a big hell yes to somebody.
Okay. I'm here.
I passed a house today that had what looked like a little dollhouse out front of it, like a large dollhouse up on a post. And upon closer inspection, it had a glass window, and inside there were books. And when you read the little sign above it, it says, free library. Take a book, leave a book. What a great idea. There were bunches of books in there, a lot of kids' books, and it was at the right height for kids. And essentially somebody had put books out there for children to take, borrow, bring back, and leave other books. There were also some books in there for adults as well. What a great idea. What a great idea. They put that right by the edge of the sidewalk on their front lawn. I think that is one of the most wonderful things. Big hell yes for those folks. Big hell yes. Don't see that every day.
I have to give a hell yes out to, and this is to Apple Executive Support, Tiffany Thomas. I have went through all the Apple stuff you're supposed to go to. I probably have 20 hours of my time invested in trying to determine what is wrong with my iPhone, and no one could do it. So while I was on my iPhone, I called and got Apple customer service and explained to them very calmly that I was at the point that I was about to burst. And what I meant by that is that I was about to sling the phone, that I was at the point that if I were the type of woman to curse, I would be cursing in the most vain way. And I am at the level that I am no longer satisfied with my phone, and I want a brand new phone, and I want you to hear me clearly. I want a brand new phone paid for by Apple. And immediately they got me to Tiffany Thomas. And within 1 hour, she had my phone corrected, and she also sent me gifts in the mail as a customer service, and again, I say not just a customer-oriented person, but customer service person. She understood my time and sent me about $400 worth of stuff.
I'm impressed. It works. It works at times.
Mm-hmm. It works at times.
Well, good for them. I mean, it's unfortunate. I'm sorry that you had to spend so much time on it, but I'm glad that you got it figured out.
Well, it was one person who figured it out, and it was her particularly. And it was the way she handled my call. It was her interest that she could hear where I was at with my technology level, and she was able to meet me there and speak at that verbiage level. And instead of walking me through a bunch of apps and pointing and clicking, she just went straight to what she thought the problem was, and it was resolved within an hour. Amazing. So,
you know,
yeah.
we should get her on the thing with the library, folks. Terry, I know, did you talk about the people with the little library and the book exchange? Yeah, here's something sorry to rain on that little story, but which is a good thing, but apparently it's been pretty common to have these little libraries. It's called, like, give a book, take a book, and they put them in front of their houses. Someone in California, in Sherman Oaks, California, got in big trouble for doing it without the proper permitting. Give me a break.
Hell no, we don't need permits.
They put a box of books in the front of our house for neighbors to give a book, take a book. That is too.
Yeah.
That's overregulation. That's just ridiculous.
It is, and hell no, we don't need that crap in our lives anymore. We need to get our lives back. Earlier this evening, I was meeting with a gentleman who just happens to be African American, and he was talking about many things with me, And I'm just going to share one point that he brought up. He is very Jeffersonian in his views of political and society and so forth. He's a very well-read and well-spoken individual. And he also strongly evinced his opposition to this political correctness bullshit that we are getting stuffed down our throats on a daily
mm-hmm.
basis. I had to deal today with an unemployment hearing on somebody who deserved unemployment about as much as, you know, the Dalai Lama deserves to be hung by his nose. I happen to have great respect, by the way, for the Dalai Lama, so you know where that comment's coming from. This individual was a lying, conniving, dishonest, accusatory individual who committed fraud and a whole bunch of other things. And the judge involved in the matter asked him one leading question after another, and when he turned to myself and my attorney, absolutely attacked us. No matter what we said, it wasn't enough, it wasn't right, it was just the ultimate kangaroo court. Guy was just a complete jerk. And here this other guy who, you know, the judge, of course, had no knowledge of the guy in terms of what happened, but we were trying to present it. It wouldn't even allow us to present some documentation that we had that showed that the guy had been paying himself twice over. And unbelievable. So anyhow, back to things. I'm wandering all over with this, but let's talk about something else here. We had a couple other things in the mix, and I think one of them was just barely touching on the political climate.
Yeah, voter apathy.
Nick, yeah,
voter apathy.
I
mean, my goodness. I've heard so many people who say, well, I'm just not going to vote. I don't like this candidate. I don't like that candidate. And it's a problem. You know, I tell people about the Supreme Court's on the line, like, important election, very important. There are a lot of things that election numbers are used to affect all sorts of different things, with depending on what your political party is. I mean, both parties, so the numbers of people who come out to vote affect delegate counts, all sorts of things. It's very important to participate in the process. And, you know, for my job, I'm a precinct chair, and my job is to call the people of my own party and get them to go out and vote. Because a lot of these people, if you think, well, that side's got it or this side's got it, there's no point in me voting, it's all rigged anyway, blah, 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 blah. You know, a lot of the things, the poll numbers and everything that's out there, a lot of that is, again, through statistics, spun this way and that to cause. I mean, half of this, you know, you think they want to cause people to say, well, it's going to be a landslide for this person, that person, don't bother showing up. Well, if everyone, you know, if you, your neighbor, and everybody else, you have like the telephone game of domino effect of not going to the polls, it's a big problem. So avoid, you know, voter apathy, big problem, big problem. Go to the polls. Exercise your right to the vote. You know, a lot of people in a lot of countries don't have the right to vote and elect their officials. And how awful of any of us who are registered to vote who don't do it. Stupid, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. But the other side of that coin is that I understand the apathy. We haven't had an election in many a year. Where we've actually had a clear-cut choice of someone who would probably be really good for the country. So what do you do? And I know that many of those folks feel that frustration, and I understand that frustration. They really don't feel that their vote is worth anything. I mean, how do you respond to that?
I tell them this. I'll say to a lot of people who think it's not worth it, there's nothing that I can hear people say, there's nothing I can do. So you spend, the same people who say there's nothing I can do, they spend hours at their smartphone, on their tablet, on their computer, whatever have you, and they're, you know, this article, that article, everything about this candidate, that candidate. If you took a chunk of that time and said, sir or ma'am, if you can read a list of bullet points, here's some friendly people in your own party. Call them up. They're in some of the battleground states. Hi, how are you? My name is so-and-so. Just want to say, are you going to vote? Are you going to vote? Okay, that's a nice phone call. Done. Boom, on to the next. You make a bunch of phone calls. You're talking to other people, interpersonal communication, voice-to-voice, not on this technology. You know, I saw something today on the news talking about the serious impact social media is having on people, because there are people who are the people who otherwise wouldn't lose their manners in public and go off as they sometimes do, have sort of immunity behind the nameless, faceless, you know, walls of Facebook, and you know, with the strangers they beat up on us. So people are being, we are all being sort of exposed to a new level of just awful communication and just the darkest of the dark in people. And, you know, I think that when we just, like, talk to people, you just never, I mean, I go on walks in my neighborhood, I stop and I talk to people, you know, you don't know, like, who they're, what they're doing. And today, this man said he wants me to come by and see, he wants to buy some pies for my charity. You know, we ended up talking about that. I mean, you know, just talk to people. There's a lot of people not on Facebook, so, I mean, just talk. And so by doing this with this election, and people who say it doesn't matter, I don't care what, I mean, whatever party you're from, get out there, talk to people, get people registered to vote, vote. Don't just sit there behind your computer spewing awful vitriol and divisive language at other people, because all it does is make you look like a big ASS.
Okay, well, I guess I asked the question and got the answer.
There you go.
Moving
there you go. Let's
moving
talk about
rapidly
hammers.
Onward.
We talk about tools now.
Okay, let's talk about tools. I like tools. Nick and I were chatting before the show, as we often do. He didn't even call me a bad name tonight. That's always an improvement.
Always nice, yeah.
Just kidding.
Nice.
He's very polite
nice
to me,
sometimes.
Especially if he's been drinking heavily. What we were talking about is the idea of doing a semi-regular feature on the show about tools. Nick brought up the idea that we hadn't talked about tools in a while, and it's a favorite subject. And I thought, well, why don't we do, you know, a tool here and there and really go into a little bit of depth about it. And let's talk about tools in general. Nick had told me about an instance where he ended up with needing some tools and not having them, and the idea of having a toolbox on his truck, to which I responded, yeah, great idea, except they do get ripped off. I lost almost $10,000 in tools at one point out of my truck. I went into a building that the toolbox was locked in my truck, went into a building for about a half hour, came back out, gone. And there are a lot of tools in there that I couldn't replace because they didn't make them anymore, which is becoming a major problem with tools, folks. So be aware that if you're looking for tools, one of the primary places you should be looking is at flea markets, you know, the used places and so on, because the better tools are only going to be available there in some instances. There are many tools that have been discontinued because people don't know how to use them. There wasn't enough call for them, so they just stopped making them. Let's talk about hammers for a minute. And Nick, do you own any hammers?
I do. I own, I have owned, I should say. I don't, right now I've got a hammer that will smash out the inside windshield or glass in a vehicle. I have a regular hammer for putting up pictures on the walls, and a flat rubber mallet. Type style hammer.
Rubber duck
hammer. Actually, I used to use the end of a rubber duck as a hammer to hit the alternator of a vehicle I had to get it to start every now and then. It was we kept that duck right up on the windshield of the dash because we thought anything bigger, more forceful than that might have been the wrong tool. And its name was Beaker.
Yeah,
I inherited after the breakup. I got Beaker's the umbrella duck. Duck umbrella, I should say.
Did you use that duck on her too, or was that
something? That why she's the ex-girlfriend? Is that the next one?
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's where there's. Never mind. I won't go into that common saying.
Moving on.
Okay, hammers. Hammers are misunderstood, poorly regarded, and usually utterly misused. Hammers are far more complex than people would ever dream of. There are literally dozens of types of hammers for various jobs. There is, for instance, an electrician's hammer. That hammer has a very long nose on it so that you can pound nails and fasteners into boxes, meaning the boxes that you put your outlets, switches, and so on. So the fore part of the hammer, the striking surface, has an elongated neck on it so you can pound without hitting the hammer on the side of the boxes. Very, very handy tool. There are all sorts of machinist hammers, mostly from years ago, because most machinists nowadays, the only thing they know how to do with the hammer is hit the computer that's running the machine out of sheer frustration. Machinist hammers are usually heavy, heavier than average hammers, and range in size from about a pound for the very smallest ones to as much as 4 pounds. And they usually have a cross peen. That means the upper surface is like the roof of a house going sideways. That's what I call a cross peen hammer. The top of the hammer in those instances is called the peen. You have the ball peen hammer, which has a rounded top, hence the name ball peen hammer. Ball peen hammers are primarily for doing heavier work, metal work. They are not made for pounding nails. The surface on the ball peen hammer is ground differently than that of a nail hammer, and you will keep slipping off the nail if you try to hit it with a ball peen hammer. They're not designed for it. Ball peen hammers are mostly for metalworking and doing machinery work and, you know, working on your car, etc. We have the claw hammer, the one that everybody thinks of as sort of the quintessential hammer. You have two basic varieties. One is a straight claw, and the other one is the curved claw hammer. Curved claw hammer is the most common. It's a nail hammer, the one you'd use around the house doing handyman things. The straight claw hammer is for tearing things apart more readily. The straight claw can dig in, and it's even not a bad gardening tool, I'll tell you, for chopping a root here and there when you don't have something else in reach. That claw is made for a number of things. You sometimes have a hammer that has two claws on it. The claw that is the primary, and then one of the tongs of one of the claws also has a notch in it for smaller nails, and those are used for, obviously, for pulling nails. Another hammer that is poorly understood is a hammer that's called the brass hammer, and it is made so that you don't damage the things that you're pounding on. Made out of brass, they're quite expensive these days, and every machinist should have one in his box because for adjusting things, you need a brass hammer. If you're adjusting things, for instance, on a lathe where things are very precision, you sometimes use a lead hammer where you don't want to harm anything. Lead hammers are very soft, and they're basically made to get beat up. As they get beat up, eventually it gets to the point where you simply take the lead hammer and melt it and recast the head on it. That happened all the time with machinists. They would—they had their favorite lead hammers. It would eventually get beaten up to the point where they couldn't use it anymore. They'd have the guy in the tool crib melt it down. They had a little mold. They stuck the handle in the mold, poured the lead in, brand new hammer in no time at all. Other hammers, blacksmith hammers. You know, who did more with hammers than blacksmiths? They're the stock and trade for the smith. Blacksmith hammers come in many varieties. The Swedish pattern happens to be my favorite. It has a square nose on it, and it has a narrow cross peen on the top. It's the thing of beauty. A well-made blacksmith hammer is an amazing tool, and they came in all different sizes. They still do come in all different sizes in terms of weight. But let's talk a little bit about how you hold a hammer and some of the differences there. You shouldn't choke a nail hammer. By choking, it means you grab it too close to the head. Hammers, for nail hammers and also for ball peen hammers, you want to hold that hammer close to the end of the handle, so you get leverage on it. You need that to whack that nail, and so you're not pushing the nail in. You're using the momentum and the weight of the hammer to do it for you. Blacksmithing is a whole different thing. Blacksmiths do choke their hammers up, and that gives them greater control in what they're doing. It's a completely different operation when a smith is working on a piece of hot metal than somebody who's banging away on a car part or someone who's pounding a nail. So once again, how to hold the hammer depends upon what hammer it is. Let's just look at another hammer, the mallet, as Nick was describing. He had a rubber mallet for adjusting his girlfriend's attitude. That's wrong, isn't it? I'm sorry. You were adjusting something.
There's going to be cops at my door.
Did it work?
She says.
I don't know. She shut up.
But there are many types of mallets, and mallets are used in both metalworking and woodworking. And there are mallets that have faces that are everything from urethane to hard rubber to industrial plastic. There are mallets that are made entirely out of wood. There are mallets that are actually round and don't look like hammers. And those are for using with wood chiseling and wood carving. Those mallets, by the way, are made of a very interesting wood most of the time. It's called lignum vitae. It is very, very hard wood, very oily wood, and it does not float. It sinks in water. It's a tropical wood and a slow-growing tree. I will usually opt for the better hammer ecologically, which is one that's made out of beech wood. They don't have to tear down a tropical tree to do that. And in the Nordic countries, they grow beech specifically for tools and for workbenches. So it's a little more humane toward the planet using the beechwood mallet. So that gives you just a little bit of a spread of some of the mallets and hammers that are out there. Now, Nick, I know there's a question you're just dying to ask me, isn't there, regarding the hammers
but outside of the hammers that float or don't float, or there's a, you know what? There is a question. You must be on to me. The different wooden, I've had wooden hammers that have broken. It makes me think of axes too. The wooden axe seems
you're
to sometimes
talking about the handles.
Break the other handle, as opposed
not
to
the hammer,
a
right.
metal-based hammer or an aluminum. Maybe it's aluminum. Is there a preference or a reason that one would go with a wood hammer versus an aluminum or metal hammer?
Yeah, we've only got a couple minutes here, but we're talking about the handle. We've got to clarify that.
Right.
Hammer handles. They range from fiberglass to tubular steel. To occasionally high-impact urethane, and certainly wood of various types. The wood-handled hammers are preferred by a lot of the old-time craftsmen because the wood absorbs a lot of the shock, and it's easier on your forearms. They have invented a number of different styles of hammers these days with shock-absorbing this and shock-absorbing that. Usually they have a rubberized collet that the handle fits into in the eye of the hammer. The eye is the part that the handle goes through. It's referred to as the eye of the hammer. It's kind of whatever you like the feel of. If you look at S-wing hammers, for instance, almost all the S-wing hammers have a steel handle with a rubber grip. Some people really like that. I tend to like the wooden handles better. And even though you can destroy them more easily, they give you a better feel for what you're doing and a better feel for your work. And one last tiny bit of information, some of the hammers are now made of a titanium alloy. It makes them very light, but at the same time gives them pretty good striking power. They do wear out on nails, by the way. They will wear out pretty quickly on nails. They're very expensive. They run anywhere from $80 to $200 for these titanium hammers. I happen to like the 16-ounce titanium hammer that's out there. I use it a fair bit. One of the reasons I like it is because it doesn't rust. I can take it down to wet areas when I'm working, and there's no rusting that takes place.
You give up a little bit
in striking power.
The one thing, we're almost out of time. The one thing that I want to add, and I'm sure Terry will agree with me, is don't cheap out on tools. When it comes to buying good quality tools, you're going to have – Get the good stuff. It'll last forever. Take care of it. I mean, I've got tools and things that were from my my great-grandparents' wood shop from, like, the 1870s, you know, all these different things that, you know, it looks like a horror movie, but, you know,
all right. Everybody,
some of it is scary, but anyways, yeah.
Have a wonderful week. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Go out and get yourself a new hammer.
All right. See y'all later. Be back next week.
Good night,
bye-bye
everyone.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Good night, Terry.